But an attempt to put across probably the debate that was going on in the Jewish community when Matthew's Gospel, I don't know whether they published things in those days, certainly not on the internet anyway. So tonight we're going to spend some time looking through how Matthew portrays the cross. A month ago Mike took us through Luke's version, so tonight it's the turn of Matthew. You guys all right over there? Okay. Matthew was one of the disciples, and prior to his calling as a disciple, he was a tax collector. After his first encounter with Jesus, he threw a party for other tax collectors so they could spend some time with Jesus. And that's about it in terms of what we know about Matthew, this writer of the gospel. There's nothing much more said, or nothing I could find out anyway. Well, who was he writing to? Well, the Jews who had become Christians. In other words, the early church in Palestine. And his whole gospel is out to prove, beyond doubt, that Jesus was the Son of God, the Messiah. Hence the little sketch at the start. The passages quoted from what we call the Old Testament were there to show the Jews the truth. They had actually missed their long-awaited Messiah. Their view of a political Messiah who would restore their lands and prosperity was wrong. God had other plans. Now, I picked out a few examples and asked a few people to read just to try and show you what Matthew was trying to do. So I think it's Ian's got Matthew 4 verses 15 and 16.
Land of Zebulun and land of Naphtali, the way to the sea along the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles. The people living in darkness have seen a great light. And those living in the land of the shadow of death, a light has dawned.
Okay, so that's a quote from chapter 9 of Isaiah. Sue, I think. Matthew 8 verse 17. Thank you. And Jane, the last one from Matthew 12. So, all quotes from Isaiah, but there are other quotes in Matthew, and demonstrating that what he was trying to do was show to his Jewish readers that Jesus was the Messiah foretold in what we now call the Old Testament. So, apart from the usual debate over whether Matthew was actually the disciple and whether it was the disciple who wrote the gospel, there are disagreements over when it was written, from 40 or 50 AD to 60 or 70 AD. But it was written. And some put it around the time of the destruction of the Temple of Jerusalem, which was around 70 AD. So the other thing that you need to try and think of as, you know, a Jew reading Matthew's gospel for the first time in those early years was that the temple had just been destroyed. The temple that had been built was the centre of their worship. It was the whole purpose of the Jewish nation. They went up there. If you think about Jesus' life, he was blessed there as a child. He taught in its courtyards. He was there for the final Passover meal in a packed Jerusalem. So Jerusalem was full of religious tourists, I guess, all going up there to worship in the temple. So it was the centre of their life. The Romans then came in and smashed it to bits after a Jewish rebellion. And that brought a change on the whole Jewish nation. No longer was it a nation focused on the temple in Jerusalem, but the synagogue then became the preeminent place for Jewish religious activity. So it was a big change. So when we read about what Jesus said during his trial a little bit later, just think back to that, the impact of not having a temple. Okay, one quick statistic, which is why I'm glad we're preaching about Matthew before Mark, is that 91% of Mark's gospel is in Matthew. So whoever's doing Mark's got a hard job. So that's the background, really, trying to set the scene. And really what we're going to try and do is look at the last 12 hours of Jesus' life with the hope, following on from what Ian and Andy have been sharing on the last two Sunday mornings, that it will help us become more intimate with God by understanding what he went through for us. Now, I watched Mel Gibson's The Passion of Christ. Anybody seen that? That's the first time I watched it. Lynn refused to watch. And I'm sure Hollywood, as ever, was not totally accurate. But it did certainly display the barbarism of the crucifixion and the anguish that Jesus went through. Andy talked a little bit about that this morning. Well, Mel Gibson didn't leave much to the imagination in terms of the flogging and the thorn, the crown of thorns. It was all very graphic and not an easy film to watch. But the message that came through to me was that the Jews were definitely guilty for the death of Jesus. And we'll come back to that later, because that's one of Matthew's themes. Okay, it's either Jane or Cedar's got 1 Corinthians 1, 20-24. I just want to remind us of what Paul said about the cross. Thanks. So this cross that we're going to look at is a stumbling block to the Jews, because they weren't looking for that. It wasn't what they expected their Messiah to do, to die on a cross. They were looking for somebody to wipe the Romans out, restore their kingdom, give them back their status as a world power, I guess. And here we have a totally different Messiah. Okay, throughout Matthew's account, there are a number of paradoxes which I'll try and bring out. There's the power versus the weakness, majesty and authority versus submission, obedience to God versus a lack of challenge to the earthly powers. Now, the story starts in Matthew 26, verse 47, and we're going to run through to the end of chapter 27. But I'm not actually going to read big chunks of it, so you probably need a Bible open and skim through it as I go. So, the arrest of Jesus, which is chapter 26, verses 47 to 56. Well, it happened at night. An armed mob came, yet Jesus had been in the temple every day, but the Jewish leaders chose not to challenge him there. They chose somewhere secretive almost. And they came ready for a fight. Now, one of Jesus' disciples drew his sword and wanted to try and fight Jesus free. But that's not what Jesus wanted. He went peacefully. And Matthew draws out the power that Jesus actually had by saying he could have drawn on legions upon legions of angels to sort it out. He didn't need to resort to swords and fisticuffs. He had about 70-odd thousand angels if he wanted. I think 6,000 in a legion, so 12, 6 is 72,000. I think that might have frightened off the Jewish authorities and their yobs. But he didn't. He chose to follow his father's will, demonstrating apparent weakness, yet he had all the power if he wanted to use it. And it's interesting to think, you know, if you were one of the 40, 50 people around Jesus in that garden at the time, how would you have reacted? Would you have run? Would you have drawn your sword if you had one? Or would you have just slipped away in the garden, moving between the shadows into the trees and slunk away? I guess I'd have been confused. Would I have really understood any better than Peter where this was all leading? Yeah. The disciples had been around him for 3 years, yet they still hadn't grasped what was going to happen. Hence the different reactions. So that's the first bit, the arrest. Moving on to the trial with the Jewish authorities in chapter 26, verses 57 to 68. How about a fixed trial? If ever there was a case for fixing a trial, this was it. False witnesses, judges who'd already made up their minds. The Jewish authorities put an awful lot of effort into getting a conviction, yet they couldn't get their witnesses to agree, even after they paid them lots of money. All the stories were conflicting. So I'll just read a couple of verses and show you how Jesus helped them out of their little dilemma. You'll have to bear with me. I broke my glasses. A bit worse than Andy's this morning, and these are not the best for reading, hence passing it round to people. Then the high priest stood up and said to Jesus, "Are you not going to answer? What is this testimony that these men are bringing against you?" But Jesus remained silent. The high priest said to him, "I charge you under oath by the living God, tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God." "Yes, it is as you say," Jesus replied. So they tried all the false witness approach and everything, and Jesus just said, "Yep, basically I am the Messiah," which helped them out a little bit, didn't it? So again, he appeared weak, but with one statement he demonstrated his power against the failings of the Jewish authorities. Now, how did the Jews react to this? Well, they went a bit mad, really. The chief priest ripped his clothes. They were shouting abuse at him. They got very cross. People hit him. They were pouring ridicule on him. Yet here was a group of men desperate for a Messiah. You know, they'd been looking for a Messiah for ages upon ages, and he was standing right in front of them. But they were blind, absolutely blind. And again, we need to ask ourselves, are we blind to Jesus in our lives? Do we ignore signals? Does Jesus bring us back to the same point again and again to see whether we will listen and will respond and will walk in his ways this time after not doing it the previous time? I'm not saying we're blind like the Pharisees and the Jewish leaders, but do we miss his promptings in our lives? And Jesus stands there and soaks up all this anger, bitterness, jealousy, hatred. And he doesn't get drawn into the events. I mean, I'd have probably shouted back and tried to hit them and put up a fight. But even with all his authority and all his power, Jesus surrenders and submits to God's will and stands there and takes it in a way that demonstrates to us how, when we're accused falsely and when we're abused in that way, how we should respond and how we should let God deal with the situation. So there's probably two other very famous people in this story, Peter and Judas. We're moving on to the end of chapter 26 and into the first 10 verses of chapter 27. We all know the story of Peter's denial, how three times before the cock crowed, he denied Jesus. And then there was Judas, who betrayed Jesus with a kiss, took the money back to the Jewish authorities. He didn't want it. He realized the error of his ways. I suppose the film does get that across quite interestingly, where it showed Judas slowly going mad and being tormented. And he ends up hanging himself. So both of these guys react to their failures. Both show remorse. Judas can't cope and ends his life. And Peter goes away and weeps. But who can turn their lives around? The one that they have actually betrayed, Jesus, can turn their lives around. He can forgive and show mercy and accept them back through his grace. It's incredible, isn't it? He accepted Peter back after those denials and built his church on it. Judas missed out, didn't he? He didn't have to hang himself. Right, moving on to the trial with Pilate in chapter 27, 11 to 26. Has Pilate had a bad press, do you think? He wanted to do the right thing, but was weak. As the song says, he predicted a riot. It's probably too modern for the people in here. I predicted a riot, yes. So he gave in to avoid the riot. Pilate was under the impression he had control, that he was exercising the power, but it was Jesus who had given him the power. Pilate didn't really have any authority unless God gave it to him. Pilate had a very clear understanding of the reason behind the actions of the Jewish authorities. He knew an injustice was happening, but his career and own self-interest was key. His wife, who had a dream telling him not to get involved and not to do anything, had an influence, and Matthew is the only one of the Gospels to mention her dream and her part in the story. It's clear from the trial of the Jews and the trial in front of Pilate that Matthew was laying the blame for the death of Jesus at the feet of the Jewish leaders and the Jewish people who blindly followed their prompting. So, Matthew, a Jew, writing to Jews, is telling them that they killed the Son of God. Interesting, isn't it? That's not going to make him very popular, I don't think. So, it would provoke a response, either hatred, because of what he was saying, or an action which would remove their guilt by accepting forgiveness from Jesus. So you can see from that, you know, it's dividing the Jews in a response. Either they're going to go, "Ah, Matthew," or, "No, I need to get right with Jesus here. I need to build my relationship back with God through Jesus." Moving on to the actual crucifixion, Matthew again draws some quotes in order to demonstrate Jesus fulfilling God's plan. From the Psalms this time, 22 verse 18 and 69 verse 21, which I won't read. But in chapter 27, verse 40, We come back to this issue around the temple when Jesus says, if I can find it, Jesus is on the cross here. Those who passed by hurled insults at him, shaking their heads and saying, "You who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourselves. Come down from the cross if you are the Son of God." Now, we know that Jesus died and rose again and is alive today. And the temple, you know, imagine reading that in AD 80 when 5, 6, 7 years after the temple in Jerusalem had been destroyed. And the temple's just a heap of rubble, and there's people going around saying, "Jesus is alive." So again, clear demonstration of the difference between how the Jews interpreted what Jesus was saying at the time and reality 30 or 40 years later when the temple's gone and Jesus is alive. And in verse 43 it says, "He trusts in God. Let God rescue him now if he wants him, for he said, 'I am the Son of God.'" Again, Jesus is still trusting in God as the people mock him. The Jewish people thought they were being clever and restoring their authority and mocking Jesus, yet Jesus had the authority. He was the Messiah. There's a number of quotes through chapter 27 which says, "If you are ... And Matthew puts that in on a number of occasions. But he was the Messiah. This is another paradox. You know, Jesus could have taken control, but he was a willing sacrifice. The Jews, as we sang, as read, were demanding miracles. But would they have believed if Jesus had come down off the cross? I mean, he performed miracles in front of them. He'd raised people from the dead. He'd fed lots of people. He'd turned water into wine. It was all there. They didn't believe it when he was living in front of them. If he'd have come down from the cross, would they have believed that? Would they have believed it if Elijah had turned up? I'm not sure. I'm not convinced. Now, the last bit of chapter 27 is possibly the most controversial. I'm going to pose some questions to you about this. So, this is the final bit of Jesus' life, and the events that are listed by Matthew at his death, do we actually believe them? So I'll read them out and you can make your own judgment. Darkness covered the land, so the sun was blotted out. Well, yes, I can believe that one. I've seen it happen when I was about 12 in school in Middlesbrough. There was a big storm and the sky went a vivid green in Middlesbrough, but that's because of the pollution. But, you know, it was pitch black at midday. So, yes, I can cope with that one. The curtain split in two. Well, that's quoted in Luke and Mark as well. And it's also part of our tradition, symbolising the move from the old to the new covenant in terms of access to the Holy of Holies, access to God. A new way open to the Father. I mean, we believe that through the bread and wine. So, yes, I'm on board with that one. But be careful, because, you know, is it tradition or is it fact? But I'm on board with that one. Now, we come to the more difficult ones, the ones that are sort of links to the Messianic, I can't say it, age. The earthquake. Well, yes, earthquakes do happen, but at 3 o'clock on the afternoon when Jesus died? No reason why it couldn't. We haven't got a seismograph to tell us it did. Tombs opening, the resurrection of the dead, the return of the saints to Jerusalem. Well, that's a bit harder to believe. Jane, would you like to read the bit from Ezekiel, please? This is Ezekiel chapter 37, verses 12 to 14. So Ezekiel predicted it 700-800 years before it actually happened. And again, Matthew's demonstrating from the Old Testament that Jesus was the Messiah. So those last two are a bit more flaky. It takes some faith to get there to believe that they happened. And they're only mentioned in Matthew's Gospel. The final one is the centurion who, when Jesus died, makes a confession that he was the Son of God. Now that's the easiest one to identify with, because we've all done that. We've all accepted Jesus as our Saviour, which is what that guy did. So, to summarise, Matthew was writing to the Jewish church. He clearly demonstrates that Jesus is the Messiah and that the Jewish people were responsible for the death of Jesus. Their only response can be to accept Jesus' free gift of grace for the forgiveness of their sins. Which brings us back to the start, that the cross is still a stumbling block to those who don't believe. So I think it's time to celebrate the death and life of Jesus with communion.